5 days, 5 minutes, what happened in the global economy and why? Also, as the GOP gets ready for its convention, we go to Cleveland. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 15th of July today. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It has been a week. Let's just say that. Nice last night, funerals and memorials in Dallas and St. Paul and Baton Rouge. The coup, or talk of it anyway, of a coup in Turkey late this afternoon. Presidential politics here all the while. We are going to take our slice of the 5 days that were, you know, the global economy and all that. Lynette Lopez and John Carney are ensconced in our bureau in New York. She's with Business Insider. John is at the Wall Street Journal. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
All right, Lynette, you get to go first. Let's begin, I suppose, here. The presidential race, Mike Pence, the governor of Indiana, will be running with Donald Trump. Do you suppose it's possible that Governor Pence, a Washington insider, if there ever was one, can impose a little
discipline?
Discipline on the economic things Donald Trump says, so like
maybe
not
just
renegotiating
like connecting
the debt,
dots.
You know. Yeah. That stuff.
Maybe creating some kind of weird platform. So far, Donald Trump's economic message has kind of been a hodgepodge of like anger and nationalism and protectionism. Maybe can Mike Pence bring him back to the global economy that actually exists and not the one that existed in 1899?
Yeah.
No. The answer is no.
John?
That's
Mike Pence has a pretty good reputation for making economic sense. He was a big tax cutter as well. So that you know, and so I do imagine that, you know, the economic advisors to Donald Trump will be relieved to be able to also talk to Mike Pence. You know, remember people like Larry Kudlow, you know, have been
These are considered serious people.
Giving advice.
And
I think they'll enjoy having Pence in the room with them now,
go ahead.
The reality is no one has ever been able to make Trump do anything Trump doesn't want to do. So to me, there's this guy who seems kind of flat. He doesn't seem particularly dynamic. I don't think he'd be able to wrest control away from Trump and his ideas.
But do you two not take the idea that Mr. Trump has done the arguably politically responsible thing here and gone with somebody who knows this system? Is that not possibly a sign that he is looking for someone who can help him hone his message in a more acceptable way as opposed to, honestly, the loose cannon way that he has kind of done it?
Yeah, I think that is what is behind this. He wanted, you know, Lynette described Pence as sort of flat and not very exciting. That's exactly what Donald Trump wanted. He's exciting enough, and he doesn't need a bomb thrower. He certainly didn't need somebody, you know, who could say as extravagant things as he does. And so Pence is probably, you know, a very good choice for that. So the message in selecting Pence is the message, right? Is the, hey, look, I can do normal things too.
Right.
But you know, he also hired a bunch of normal people to run his campaign recently, and they haven't been able to do that.
And
so
they have left, yeah.
You know.
All right. We will move on from the politics of it and get me straight to the economics of it. There was, you know, bank earnings are out this week, Lynette. They are solid. Retail sales were up. Consumers, by all indications, are doing well. And yet there's a little bit of out there, yeah?
Yeah, there's a ton of ever since Brexit, so the global economy started tanking in February and everybody thought we were all on fire. Then we kind of stopped, dropped and rolled and figured out what we were doing. And now with Brexit, so that's what you're seeing in these second quarter earnings. But now with Brexit, that whole issue has introduced a bunch of tail risk. As in, you know, now nobody knows what's going to happen to the UK. Nobody knows if other European nations are going to want to leave the EU. There's now a bunch of uncertainty in the market. And I don't think that what we saw the last 3 months is going to continue into the next quarter. So, okay, yeah, we've got some great bank earnings, but the global economy has changed since then dramatically.
John, roll the Turkey news of late this afternoon, the talk of the coup over there,
right.
That whole uncertainty equation.
So what we're definitely learning is, you know, a lot of things that nobody would expect to happen. You know, the leave vote winning in Britain, and now possibly a coup, or at least an attempted one underway in Turkey. Yeah, that does create a lot of uncertainty. I will say that, ironically, this might actually be good for some of the biggest banks because they, you know, Citigroup, when discussing its earnings today, actually pointed out that a lot more trading happened around the Brexit vote, and that boosts their revenue. So
money,
it could actually. It can help, you know, as long as things don't get overly crazy, a little bit of craziness can help out the banks. But and so, you know, they're probably, you know, they're not excited that there's a coup in Turkey, but they are, they do like a little bit of a.
Lynette, go ahead.
This is like riding a bucking bronco. You can't control it. So, you know, if the economy starts going haywire, you can't just say, OK, this is enough volatility. Now we stop. That's not what happens. So I think people are going to be obviously watching this really closely. I would just really like to have one really boring day, though. Can we just do nothing tomorrow, world?
Tomorrow works for me. Lynette Lopez at Business Insider. John Carney from The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, you two.
Have a good weekend and hope nothing happens.
Yeah, right. Yeah. We'll take tomorrow off.
Thanks, Kevin.
On Wall Street today, it was all right. You know, quite a week. A little up, a little down. Today, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. The corporate slash Wall Street slash man, there has been something curious about this company for a while now. Story of this Friday comes to us courtesy of the controversial nutrition supplement company Herbalife. It's reached a $200 million settlement with the Federal Trade Commission, one of the FTC's biggest in point of fact. The company sells supplements through what is known as multi-level marketing. It sells product to people who then get paid to recruit other sellers. The FTC claims the company's practices are unfair and deceptive. The company has agreed to change the way it does business as a result. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that one.
For years, Herbalife has been battling accusations that it's a pyramid scheme. Now the Federal Trade Commission has weighed in, sort of.
I'm not saying that they're not a pyramid scheme.
Edith Ramirez is chairwoman of the FTC. She isn't saying Herbalife is a pyramid scheme either. What the FTC alleges is that the company deceived people.
Herbalife misled people into believing that they could make lots of money by selling Herbalife products, and we contend that that was actually not the case.
The company promised that sellers who got into the Herbalife business could get rich. In fact, according to the FTC, it cost people $3,000 to $8,500 to buy into the program, but they made on average just $300 a year.
You have a compensation structure that emphasizes the purchase of product and the recruitment of others rather than selling product to end users.
In a statement, Herbalife said that many of the allegations by the FTC are factually incorrect and that it is paying the $200 million settlement only because continuing litigation would be distracting and costly.
I view it as a very positive resolution for Herbalife.
Tim Ramey is a securities analyst at Pivotal Research Group. As part of the settlement, Herbalife will have to reward sellers mostly based on actual retail sales, not just how many other sellers they recruit. The company will also have to keep track of retail receipts, which it hasn't done in the U.S.
They actually do this in China right now. The changes are not extremely onerous.
Unless, of course, Herbalife doesn't really have many retail sales. In that case, the settlement could be the company's undoing. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
So here's one from the Sometimes the Economy is Counterintuitive file. That which appears bad is perhaps good. The number of people enrolling in college is down. That's from the U.S. Department of Education. Could spell good things economy-wise because it means people are looking for and finding jobs instead of going to community colleges or trade schools. But it is not such great news for for-profit colleges, places like DeVry and the University of Phoenix. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more on how those schools are dealing with economic reality, tougher regulation, and, yes, some pretty bad PR.
These numbers are for enrollment in 2014, and the drop was about 10% from the previous year, which means they don't reflect some major changes in regulation, like a requirement that these colleges show what jobs students got after graduating to prove it was worth it. A lot of these students tend to be lower income and older, and schools are struggling to sign them up.
The for-profit sector enrollment increases in the 2000s were basically based on the idea that you could get a lot of new enrollment. And so if a student dropped out or graduated, you'd have two or three new students to replace them.
Kevin Kinzer teaches education policy at Penn State.
They're just not being able to recruit the number of new students they need to take over from the students that are dropping out and graduating. So it's math.
I would imagine these numbers would continue to drop.
Ben Miller is with the Center for American Progress. He says there's a segment of for-profit education that isn't able to change with the times.
And that's mostly on the lower level training around certificates and some associate degrees. That business model, I think, is on its way out.
There's also been a ton of bad PR. Google for-profit education and you get a lot of negative articles, like one calling it a $35 billion cesspool of fraud. That makes a lot of potential students wary. Again, Kevin Kinzer.
I think many of them are coming to the conclusion that it might not be, at least at the prices and the risks in terms of financial aid that these institutions are relying on.
And prices are generally lower than last year. Even that isn't helping enrollment. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I would say in the 21st century, you shouldn't have people's hungry. You shouldn't have people's homeless.
Nah, you shouldn't. We go to Cleveland for a story on race and poverty and economic mobility. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 10 points today, less than a 10%, finished at 18,516. Did the blue chips, the NASDAQ down 4 points, less than a 10%. 5,029. The S&P 500 down 2 points, also less than a tenth, about 2,161 there. For the week, though, records all over the place. The Dow gained 2%, the NASDAQ up 1.4%, the S&P 500 up 1.5%. Shares of Chipotle Mexican Grill lost some spice today, down 3.1% after an analyst report that the chain is struggling to win back customers after that E. coli outbreak. We told you earlier, nutritional supplement company Herbalife has settled for $200 million with a Federal Trade Commission. Shares up nearly 10% higher on the day. Bond prices down. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.57%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Republican National Convention gets going next week in Cleveland, Ohio. We'll have a team there getting the economic slice of the biggest political story of the year. History in the making, as they say. But sometimes, oftentimes, really, history tells us more about what's actually going on in this country than the day's news does.
So, as I say, I think it's a terrible reflection on our society. I think the people elsewhere in the country have very little personal knowledge or information about it.
That's Bobby Kennedy in April of 1967 on what became known as his poverty tour of the Mississippi Delta.
But it exists, and it seems to me that we should do something about it. It's long overdue, and I don't think an inadequate poverty program or a poverty program that's on the books and sounds good but is inadequately funded might solve our conscience, and we might say that we are doing what we should, but when the fact is that we're not doing what we should be doing in this country to deal with this problem.
Kennedy was appalled by what he saw. Shacks with dirt floors, children with distended bellies, surviving on meals of biscuits and molasses. Not enough clothing to go to school, and all of them black. And that helps explain how I wound up at the end of a long, torn-up dirt road on a steamy July morning not far from the town of Cleveland, Mississippi, sitting and talking with Catherine Wilson.
I'm going to show you a picture.
Okay.
Okay? And I want you to tell me what you remember out of this. So this is 1967. That's Bobby Kennedy right there.
Okay, and
right
here.
And who's that lady in the striped dress?
Oh, my goodness.
That's a nice smile, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's you in history right there. That's pretty cool.
Well, I see.
Our election project with NewsHour and Frontline is called How the Deck is Stacked, the economic issues behind all the bluster of the campaign. Today, race, poverty, and economic mobility in America. When Kennedy came here to Cleveland and the Mississippi Delta in 1967, the war on poverty had been going on for 3 years. Catherine Wilson was a teenager at the time, living with her mother.
You remember that?
Oh, yeah, it was a big deal. I remember him. That was a joyous time for me.
Joyous time?
Yeah, we enjoyed him. Talking, he played with the children and things. And
what did he want to know? What did he ask you about?
Yeah, so he asked my mom what they want him to do. So they told him they want jobs and housing.
What happened after he left? Did you get the jobs and the houses? You got some, right?
Yeah, we got the houses over here, the houses here. We didn't have no houses when he came.
So these houses are the ones that came after Bobby Kennedy?
After he came.
It's a community called Freedom Village, but mostly it's a failed experiment. Plans were for 50 homes, housing for black farmers who'd been forced off the farms, also a laundromat and a convenience store. But they never got that far. Just a handful of the homes that were built are still standing, and most of them, honestly, including Ms. Wilson's, are in pretty desperate condition.
How's your life right now?
Well, I think I'm better than I used to be. We don't have nobody to come, you know, just tell us what to do and get up. And, you know, back then in the 60s, just like we had to move from home to home because we didn't have enough to eat, enough money to survive on. But now we understand that we don't have to go.
That's one good news. You
don't have to go. I don't have to go. Now we own our own land property.
You get to do what you want.
Yeah. I believe it's still a little better. It's better than it used to be in the 60s. It got to be.
It's got to be.
Yeah.
You're 68-ish, right?
Right. I'm 68 now.
Your mom lived in 97?
She lived in 97.
So you're going to be around another 30 years, maybe.
Well, I pray to God I do. And I hope to see not just be here, neither. I want to see action.
You want to see action?
Progress. Better than it was 50 years ago. I'm looking on further up the road. But I still believe.
You still believe?
I still believe. I ain't giving up freedom. Right.
And you know what you know what that takes me back to? You saying that?
What?
Takes me back to that smile right there. You still believe?
I still believe.
When he arrived, it was a particularly wrenching time for the Delta.
Ellen Meacham teaches journalism at the University of Mississippi. She's also the author of a book coming out next year called Delta Epiphany, RFK in Mississippi. She's the one who helped us track down Catherine Wilson.
The Delta has always been poor, but herbicides, pesticides, all of that made it easier and cheaper for the farmers to just go ahead and fully mechanize. So you had tens of thousands of people who, just in the spate of very few years, didn't have the work in the fields anymore. And some of the war on poverty programs that were well-meaning had actually made it a little worse and actually made people hungrier.
Today, almost 50 years after Bobby Kennedy was here, Mississippi is ranked 50th among the states in poverty. One in five households live below the poverty line, one in 10 in deep poverty. Just off the main drag in Cleveland, Highway 278, there's an old powder blue building. Looks a bit like a stretched out double wide. It's a restaurant called the Country Platter.
Hey.
How are you, Mr. Williams?
Fine. How are you?
I'm well.
Jimmy Williams owns the place.
Can we sit? Have a little chat?
Yeah.
Mr. Williams is getting a new front door installed, so he's had to close up for the day. It's a break for the proprietor, actually.
I'm in the restaurant every morning around 3 o'clock.
3 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah, I'm here. Because the simple reason, we cook everything. We don't have canned food. We do.
You do it all
cook
yourself?
Everything. Yeah. I cook about 95% of it.
Williams has lived in Cleveland his whole life, all 70 years of it come October.
Well, this place is a historical site. Back during the Civil Rights Movement, you know, all the people that were coming to Cleveland would meet here.
Martin Luther King, Ralph Abernathy, local hero M.Z. Moore. Williams says all of them ate here.
They would come in the back, go out the front. Come in the front and go out the back for safety.
Just over 12,000 people live in Cleveland today. The town is split pretty much right down the middle, half black and half white.
It could be a whole lot better now. It should be. I would say in the 21st century, you shouldn't have people hungry. You shouldn't have people homeless.
You do a thing here about food and the kids and who can't afford to buy food. Tell me about that.
Well, you have so many kids that they are hungry. You know, and we try to feed them. And I mean, it's a full home-cooked meal.
You just give it away.
Give it away. We got a whole book up there that people...
Book of people who you
feed.
Yeah,
we feed every day.
That list of people Williams feeds for free, by the way, it's 9 pages long. I asked him, since we had some time, to show us around his hometown.
Y'all ready to roll?
Once we get going, William says there are two Clevelands. We got to see. Old railroad tracks used to run right down the middle of the town. The tracks have been torn up, but they're not gone.
So we are still divided to a certain extent.
Do you feel it? You feel it every day?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But you can't say nothing about it. You know, they...
You can't even say anything about it?
No.
You just don't talk about it?
When you're in business, they can cut you off, you know.
What side of the track are we on now? We're on the...
We're on the east side.
Yeah.
East side of the track. Now, this is Lee Street here.
Yeah. By the Family Dollar and liquor and wine store.
Right. And next thing, they got so many town loans and check cashing places here. These are shotgun houses that we had back in the day in the country.
Yeah, sure they are.
People live in those things. And this is Christmas Street here. This is the oldest street in the black community. And the guy living this old house here on Christmas Street.
Yeah.
See, this is what I'm talking about right here. Growed up. Wow. He lives in there.
Plastic bags over the windows.
Yeah.
And
every car he ever owned sitting in the yard.
Five, six, seven cars in there.
Yeah.
Look at that. That's like a junkyard. That's not a garage. That's a
junkyard. Right in the yard.
Yeah.
I just don't think people should be living like that. I mean, they allow this over here. Yeah. You couldn't put that on the other side of the track.
Nope.
Yeah, this one used to be one of the best looking streets in Cleveland when I was a kid. You know, we had our 50th class reunion.
Yeah.
And some of the guys hadn't been here in 50 years. And they said worse off now than were when they were here.
And say, what that, say that again. Worse off now than 50 years ago?
Yeah. And it's really, it's sad. And this is the track right here where it's divided.
Oh, yeah.
The east from the west. Okay, now we enter the note to the west side
so
of Cleveland.
So look at this, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't take but a half a block.
Yeah, I mean, that's just the way it is. When you cross the track, it's much different than daylight and dark.
This is literally the other side of the tracks.
Yeah. See all of this here?
Oh, yeah. These are some great houses.
They keep it up. You know, they keep the grass cut. See, they keep all the trash picked up.
Kind of goes without saying, but I'm going to say it anyway. It's the black folk who live on the other side, and it's the white folk who live on this side.
Right, absolutely. That's what you got.
Why do you think it's still this way?
Because they still... This, I think it's more of a racist problem. They don't want to see people do good, you know. The ones that down, they want to keep them down. You got a few people that are up. And those are the ones they want to deal with, you know.
So the system, to use a word that's in the political dialogue today, you think the system is rigged against you?
Yeah, I think it is. I really do. But you do get the picture.
Yeah, I get the picture.
It's pretty clear there are two economies in Cleveland. The West Side is home to Delta State University and the new Grammy Museum, a country club. And while there are a handful of new houses and apartments on the east side, there are also plenty of liquor stores, and payday lenders, fast food places, and a layaway furniture shop. But the statistics paint an even starker picture of the racial and economic divide here than the aesthetics and the geography do. The unemployment rate for whites in Cleveland is 6%. For blacks, it's 22%. The median income for a white family is just over $32,000 a year. For a black family, just over $13,000. And the poverty rate for whites who live in Cleveland is 12%. For blacks, 37%. We're going to meet back on those railroad tracks on Monday, where those tracks used to be, anyway, to talk to some people about where Cleveland and in some ways this country go from here in the national conversation about race, mobility, and income inequality. There's a chance, we ought to tell you, that depending on where you live, we're going to be preempted on Monday by NPR's coverage of the GOP convention in the other Cleveland. If that happens to you, well, first of all, that's a shame, but we've got you covered. Subscribe to our podcast feed. It'll come right to you, marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today, in which Hasbro catches up with the times. The game maker says it's getting rid of Mrs. White, the female housekeeper character in its classic game Clue. She'll be replaced by a more professionally accomplished woman, Dr. Orchid, a PhD in plant toxicology, and based on appearances, also of Asian descent. A Hasbro executive said it was a difficult decision to say goodbye to Mrs. White, but after 70 years of suspicious activity, we decided that one of the characters had to go, end of quote. Also, you know, reality. All right, we got to go. Remember, if we don't air where you live on Monday, check us out online, marketplace.org. The Dow Industrials up 10 points today, less than a 10%. The NASDAQ down about 4, less than a 10% there. S&P 500 down 2 points, also less than a 10%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitara Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have a good weekend, everybody. This is APM.